Katie, make a start.
Yep.
Well, Katie, make a start, everyone. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming, and especially thank you to our guest speaker this morning. We're very grateful also to Newcastle Trades Council and Northern Regional NEU and South Tyneside Trades Council for sponsoring our meeting this morning. Apparently, I have to remind.
We can't hear now, let's stay.
Okay.
Please. Sorry.
It's all right. Thank you for letting me know.
Yeah, a lot better. Thank you.
Oh, nothing's happening. Hello.
Yes.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I was just saying thank you all for coming and welcome, and thanking our sponsors who are up on the board there. And we're very privileged we've got Andrew Murray with us this morning to speak to us. But before then, I have to tell you where the loos are, which are through there.
Yeah.
And the fire exit is straight that way. And we're not expecting an alarm this morning. But you don't have to use that door for some reason. I don't understand. But there you go, out there. Okay, so do let me know at any stage of things if you can't hear or you're not comfortable in any way. That's fine. So Andrew, of course, everybody knows who's he's a writer for Morning Star, for those of you who do get it, and those of you who don't, it's worth buying on a regular basis. Andrew was a former chair and member, a founder of Stop the War Coalition, and originally the chair, and he's now vice president of Stop the War Coalition. And for those who don't know, Stop the War Coalition is dedicated to preventing and ending all wars. And as a friend of mine said to me, well, which war is it now? And I just said, any war, anywhere. So we protest against racism and Islamophobia, anti-Semitism and the abuse of Palestinian rights. And we were right against in the invasion of, particularly of Afghanistan and Iraq. And now we're speaking about the appalling war that's going on our doorstep in Ukraine. But all wars are bad, and we mustn't differentiate one from the other. And we are not Putin's apologists, but we are here to understand what's causing these wars and what we can do about stopping them. So I'll go straight over to Andrew. Just to let you know, he has also written a book called Is Socialism Possible in Britain? That you might be interested in reading. And he's also wrote The Fall and Rise of the Left in Britain as well. So that those are of interest to you. Of course, he was a former Unite aficionado, I think that's what you might call him, and also an advisor to Jeremy Corbyn for 2 or 3 years. But now he's retired and he can come and help us with these sort of things. I'm sure he never stops working. Okay, Andrew.
Thank you. I think I probably won't need that. Probably won't need the microphone. Well, thanks for the invite to come up here, and congratulations on organising this meeting today, because, you know, small as these steps are, they are all important to breaking through a sort of wall of complacency, I suppose, that is surrounding the international situation today, where it seems to me that the world is on the threshold of the gravest dangers, but no one is really alert, or no one in Britain, in official Britain, in political Britain, parliamentary Britain, media Britain, is alert to what those dangers are. Now, I guess I must have come to Newcastle, I don't know, 20 times over the years of the Stop the War Coalition that I've been involved in it, to speak at meetings about the wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and so on. Dreadful wars that they all were. At none of those meetings could I really have plausibly said to you, we're on the edge of a Third World War, or there is a danger of a nuclear war breaking out as a result of those conflicts. They were awful wars, illegal, unjustified, with catastrophic consequences, but they didn't stretch to that perspective of possible nuclear annihilation. But that is the danger we face today, arising from the conflict in Ukraine, which, despite, is a sort of paradoxical situation. There's a sort of deadlock on the battlefield, but a relentless escalation around it in terms of arms pouring in terms of rhetoric, in terms indeed of the normalisation of the idea of nuclear war, that this war might lead to nuclear weapons being used, and no one has their foot on the brake, everyone has their foot on the accelerator. Right now, we are waiting for, and have been for some time, to what was originally going to be a spring offensive by the Ukrainian army. I think they've probably missed the season now. It'd have to be a summer offensive. And all the while, the Ukrainian president is touring the world, getting more weapons, getting more arms, and yet, in actual fact, very little is happening to change the front lines in the Ukraine. The whole situation speaks to the common sense of negotiations and a peaceful settlement, and yet all the rhetoric, all the actions, including from the major NATO powers, is of escalation, regardless of the possible consequences of that. Now, here is a problem that we face in the labour movement here in Britain. If you were to say to any trade union audience like this one, any trade union audience at all, virtually, or any labour audience at all, that Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak can be trusted with your economic future, with social policy, with our public services, you would be laughed to scorn. No one, after 13 years of austerity and crisis and the fall in the cost of living and the immense strike action we've seen over the last 12 months, would give that idea house room for a second. And yet too many in our movement assume that when it comes to a matter of foreign policy, somehow these politicians are acting in the national interest. That the Boris Johnson who lies, who uses the pandemic as an opportunity for sensational corruption, is a different Boris Johnson to the one that flies to Kiev to stop Zelensky engaging in any peace negotiations. They assume that the Liz Truss, who crashed the economy in a month in office with her reckless policies, is a different Liz Truss to the one that goes around the world beating the drum for confrontation with Russia and, for that matter, China. There's a belief that these international events have no connection with the class struggle that we face in Britain. But in fact, they are deeply connected, and the same politicians who we would not trust with our public services, with the NHS, for a second, are the same ones that are dragging Britain into the most dangerous situation it has been in for many, many years. Now, I just want to say a word about, I suppose, the substance of the Ukraine war, because there's a lot of misunderstandings around it, misunderstandings generated by propaganda that pits the whole thing as a very simple and straightforward plucky little Ukraine playing the role that Belgium did in 1914 or Poland did in 1939 up against an authoritarian aggressor. Now, like many falsehoods, that has an element of truth. But I would like to frame it as the Ukraine war is three wars in one. That's not unusual. Pure, simple, and utterly straightforward wars don't occur all that often. Three wars in one. Firstly, there is a civil war within Ukraine, which has been going on at least since 2014 as a shooting war, when the elected, if corrupt, Russian-oriented president was overthrown and driven out of office by Ukrainian nationalists. This war has Ukrainian nationalism pitched against that considerable minority of the Ukrainian population who are either Russian or Russian-speaking or Russian-oriented by culture and history. It speaks to the fact that Ukraine includes territories that have never been governed from anywhere other than Moscow in the whole of the history, really, going back to Middle Ages, and territories that, apart from the latter part of the Soviet period, were never governed from Moscow. Now, those fault lines aren't unique to the Ukraine by any means. They could have been solved democratically. Ethnicity is not destiny, and history doesn't bind the future either. But Ukraine never rose to that democratic level, and this simmering tension was always likely to break out. And it speaks to the fact that the Soviet Union, when it was dissolved, internal barriers overnight became interstate barriers. If you were living in the Soviet Union, it didn't particularly matter where the boundary between Ukraine and Russia was, because you were all governed from Moscow and all ruled by the same Communist Party. So overnight, these become interstate boundaries, and it's not just between Ukraine and Russia. You can see conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan, conflicts across Central Asia, for the same reasons that suddenly minorities who really weren't minorities in the context of the Soviet Union found themselves minorities in the new states. That civil war in Ukraine blew up in 2014. It's cost about 14,000 or 15,000 lives already by this stage before the Russian invasion of last year. That resolving that has to be key to establishing a lasting peace in Ukraine. The second war is the war that everyone recognises, the war caused by Russia's attack on Ukraine beginning in February last year. Stop the War Coalition has condemned that. It's unjustified, it's clearly illegal, it's had the most dreadful consequences for the people of the Ukraine, and it has not resolved any single issue. It is a crime and a blunder by the Russian leadership. Now, that resolving that war depends on acknowledging unequivocally the sovereignty of Ukraine, the right of the Ukrainian people to forge their own destiny, which must also include acknowledging the rights of minorities within Ukraine. The third war, and the most dangerous one, is the proxy war. The war that has been stimulated, firstly, by the relentless expansion of NATO eastwards since the end of the Cold War, in defiance of promises made by the American leadership to the Soviet leadership at the time, that has pushed NATO up against Russia's borders. It's a war that is rooted, and here there is a commonality with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, in the drive of the US to be the sole superpower and to maintain its hegemony across the whole of as much of the world as possible by means of force if needs be. And here, while one can say the Russian invasion of Ukraine is unjustified, and we do, you cannot say it is unprovoked. Russia had been warning for 20 years or more that this expansion would lead to a conflict, and yet the expansion was relentlessly pursued. And people now talk as if objecting to NATO is somehow irrational. We're told it's a defensive alliance. We're told it only operates if one of its members are attacked. Those are falsehoods. Until 1991, it is true, NATO was not involved in any aggressive military operations. Of course, the United States was on a grand scale. Britain was sometimes. But NATO as a body was not. Since then, NATO has not only expanded geographically, it's not only expanded the scope of its operations to include places that are a long way from the North Atlantic, it's also changed its mandate to being a proactively aggressive force. The war on Yugoslavia in 1999, that was a NATO war, a NATO operation, notwithstanding that Yugoslavia had not attacked or threatened any NATO power. The occupation in Afghanistan from 2003 onwards, That was a NATO occupation, notwithstanding that Afghanistan threatened no NATO power at all and is about as far as you can get from the North Atlantic. The bombing of Libya in 2011, a war people often forget about, yet has had consequences as dreadful as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and certainly has contributed mightily to a huge refugee crisis. That was a NATO operation, done under the banner of NATO. So that is three aggressive operations. Libya too, of course, had no capacity or intention to threaten any NATO power with attack, that have been conducted by NATO in the last generation. So if Russia, or anyone, sees the expansion of NATO as a threat, it is rational. And this proxy war now, being driven by NATO, because it is a fact that Ukraine's position would be would have to look for peace without NATO's support and NATO pushing them onwards. It's a proxy war designed to weaken Russia and, behind it, China. America is absolutely clear. China is the ultimate threat. It's a much more powerful economy, much more powerful state altogether than Russia is. And we've seen in the last 10 years a relentless escalation of military activity in the Far East, in the South China Sea. I mean, the clue is in its name. It's not the West California Sea. And Britain signing that pact with Australia and the USA, the AUKUS pact, for an escalation of the nuclear arms race in the Pacific. When we had our two new aircraft carriers, the one that didn't break down by the Isle of Wight and have to go straight back to port, was sent over to the Far East to intimidate China. So this is an escalating proxy war in which Ukraine is the present first stage battlefield between the United States and those powers, Russia and China, which they see as opposed to their project of world domination. That is not to excuse Russia and Putin, but Russia, however one characterizes it, is not capable of world domination, has no capacities or aspirations along that line. So this is the challenge we're facing, how to move to a peace that addresses all those three wars. And while it sounds very complicated, probably the outlines of it really aren't so complicated, but we have to get the politicians to prefer to look for peace than to carry on with this war, which of course suits the arms industries mightily, since they are selling huge amounts of hardware to the combatants. And that is where we have to focus on the British government's role and British politics. Just yesterday, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, a feature article, saying Britain and the United States are now splitting over the Ukraine war. And this was the split. Britain is more aggressive in promoting this war than even the United States of America. And they pointed out two particular facts to underline this. That while the quantity of American arms sent to Ukraine is far greater than the British, or greater than anyone, because of their much bigger capacity, only Britain is selling its most advanced weapons, cruise missiles, depleted uranium, being sent there. So Britain is giving Ukraine the most advanced weapons that it can use to attack Russia, in a context where no one can say where that attack would stop if it were successful. Would it stop in Donbass? Would it stop in... would it try and go for Crimea? Storm Sevastopol? Which we really would be on the threshold of nuclear war at that point. The second thing they said is that British special forces, the SAS, the Special Boat Service, other like forces, there are more of them there than there are from any other country, including America. And also, the article said, they are very close to the front line. They're helping with intelligence, with targeting, as far as we know, not actually firing guns. But think, if they're that close to the front line, how easy it would be to them to actually get involved in combat. When they get involved in combat, and if they do, it would be hard to conceal if people start dying or start being taken prisoner, then you are, again, on the brink of a much broader and even more devastating war. So here is Britain, ahead even of the centre of international aggression, Washington, in promoting this war. That has been the policy of Boris Johnson, the policy of Liz Truss, and the policy of Rishi Sunak. And here's the thing. No one in Parliament, no one is opposing it. We have the most aggressive government in the world, at least amongst the great power, the big powers on this issue. And we have an official opposition that is lamentably misnamed that does not oppose this policy on any single point. It does not even raise questions. But it's not that it does nothing. No, the official opposition sanctions any of its own MPs who want to ask a question. Any MP who questions NATO's record, they sanction any constituency Labour Party that wants to affiliate to Stop the War Coalition or any similar organisation. The only initiative Keir Starmer has taken in dealing with the war is to eliminate dissent and try and bring the whole House of Commons to a state of cowed consensus in support of this most dangerous policy. It's not entirely passive, as I said. Apart from the authoritarianism, it is championing increases in defence spending. And here's the tragedy. At last year's TUC, the TUC actually voted to campaign for an increase in military spending. Not just the argument that we're familiar with, and certainly I am from my time in Unite, about the need for workers in defence industries, their jobs to be preserved in any transition. You don't want skilled workers losing their posts. But no, to campaign for an increase in military spending at a time when the whole movement is fighting to protect vital public services, is fighting to protect the living standards of its members, that we should make a priority of increasing the arms bill. Now, that was a stain on the record of the TUC, and I hope all trade unionists will be working through their particular unions to secure a reversal of that position at this year's Congress. But it's an utterly unrealistic perspective, apart from anything else. The Royal United Services Institute, which is not a body associated with the left, they said that to meet this target of 3% of GDP going on defence spending, that's the target been championed by the government, it's the target been championed, as far as I understand it, by the Labour Party too. To increase from the present 2% to 3%, this would require either an increase in income tax and VAT of 5%, or corresponding cuts in public services elsewhere. Now, neither Rishi Sunak nor Keir Starmer are going to put up income tax by 5%. So we are really talking about massive cuts in other public services already on their knees from a decade or more of austerity in order to fund increased militarism. And of course, the war in Ukraine is being used to build up Russian threats to Britain. Behind that, there's supposed to be a Chinese threat to Britain, still more far-fetched, to justify increased militarism and the impoverishment of the public services. And it's shameful that the TUC went along with that, those line of arguments last year, and we need to get that defeated. Just as we need to break through the wall of silence that the politicians are imposing on the debate around this war at the moment. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, where it seemed to be the front lines haven't really changed for 9 months in Ukraine, not substantially. There's been a dreadful carnage around Bakhmut, which has been treated like Verdun in the First World War, where generals on both sides use it to try and bleed the enemy dry. But substantially, there has been a deadlock. Well, waiting on this offensive, I mean, it may have started for all we know, but it may not have any great effect. So we have a situation where neither Russia nor Ukraine are able to change the position on the ground very much by force. This just cries out for peace, for an opportunity for peace talks and for serious negotiations that address all the issues, the rights of minorities in Ukraine, the sovereignty of Ukraine as against Russia, and security for all, security arrangements that don't just depend on the expansion of NATO, because if security is not for everyone, it's not for anyone in the end. These sort of peace plans are easy enough to imagine. They are supported by most of the world, by population, in fact. The great majority of the global south are not interested in taking sides in this war, and they are not interested in supporting the sanctions and the arms race being led by the USA and Britain. China has produced a plan for peace. Lula from Brazil has said he wants to play a part in peace. The South Africans have rejected all attempts by Washington to get them to line up behind Biden's policy. It's even a situation where Iran and Saudi Arabia are on the same side in wanting peace. So the war at that level has highlighted the isolation of the NATO powers from most of the rest of humanity. They all want peace. They believe it is possible, and they believe it should be working for it now. Only in British politics is ceasefire a dirty word. We have to challenge that and say that the dirty word is actually nuclear annihilation, and that now is the time to be pushing for peace and to be demanding that the British government stop its reckless escalation of this war, its reckless promotion of continuing conflict, and get on the side of peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That was absolutely brilliant and